Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
Well, you mentioned your grandma at the very beginning of our podcast, and do you have more to say about that and about her? Because it sounds like that was a sort of a special relationship.
Yeah, it still is. So my grandma is a tremendous ally in the family. I had this experience during our family Christmas dinner where my other grandma, who apparently didn't know that I was gay. Here I was thinking I was out to everyone at this point. I mean, I'm out on Facebook, and my other grandma didn't know that I was gay. This is grandma number three. On my dad's side, I have two grandmas, not from a lesbian relationship.
Yeah, me too. Remarriage, it happens, right?
Yeah, she made a comment while I just stepped away from the table, and she'd made a comment about how this certain political figure was gay. And she said it in a very derogatory way. And grandma number two just jumped on her.
Okay.
I listened to that from the other room. And
the grandma that had refused a sacrament to be in solidarity with you came to your defense again.
What do you mean he's gay? And what does that have to do with anything? And then later that night, I took the opportunity to tell the offending grandma, like, "Grandma, you know that I'm gay, right?" We had a really positive experience where she recounted to me every gay friend she's ever had and how she really loved them, which is a funny response. But, you know, that grandma that I came out to and who was so affirming at church and things, she has continued to be a tremendous ally for me and this source of support, where I will always know that she always had my interest first and every other interest came secondary. And that is it means a lot to me. It's a very strong grounding force in my life.
Well, those are the kind of formative things we really need to take with us through life, because, you know, your grandma will pass, but that thing that she instilled in you, and she probably instilled it much younger in other ways, you know, but there was certainly affirming at that time. Those stay with us throughout our lives and give us our strengths, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. I mean, I see that as a huge difference between my trajectory and some of the trajectories of some of my friends at BYU. I mentioned that I had a bunch of friends that I'd met through the Mattis Firesides or other things. And at the beginning, all of us were 12, about 12, give or take, gay men who were living the LDS life and wanting the LDS life and deciding that we would be celibate or we were pursuing dating women to different degrees. And in their lives, I've seen it's been a great experiment to watch. I mean, those that don't have family support struggle, and they struggle hard. They are constantly at battle with themselves, and it takes a deep toll on how well they've been able to progress. You know, which ones have graduated from school and which ones haven't, has fallen along those lines, which ones have found meaningful relationships, and which ones have found more, you know, have been kind of stuck in a period of a cycle of self-loathing and then getting into risky sexual situations and then going back to their self-loathing. You know, all of this kind of falls along the lines of who has family support.
And so you have real life people that you're watching this play out. Of these 12 guys, there's a group of you who have family support, and consistently this group of people are the ones who are getting on with their lives, who are getting on with their careers, who are finishing their school, who are avoiding drugs and alcohol, who are pursuing healthy relationships, gay relationships, but healthy ones, compared to the ones who are have the negative family influences, and those ones you're consistently seeing them struggle, both with school, both with their life, both with risky sexual behaviors. That's compelling.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad for your friends to be your anecdote of what can happen, but it's played out in the lives of my friends.
And that's really consistent with what the research is showing, and I really want to continually plug the Family Acceptance Project research that Dr. Caitlin Ryan and Dr. Bob Reese have been doing, and the pamphlet they put out, because that's really highlights that situation, that they're showing a much higher suicidal rates in the futures. Well, what we're saying is that in these kids who are in these really homophobic environments where they're getting negative messages and who are not affirmed at all, those same people go on and later attempt suicide. They later go on and try drugs. They later go on and have risky sex. And not just a little more, but a lot more, 8 times the rate of suicide attempts. And this is pretty compelling. But, you know, here you are in your life, you're just seeing this firsthand play out. The good news is that you had a group of friends who were getting the family support. And so now there's more examples of that. People like you, people like me, I was an early winner. I mean, I didn't have direct support about my orientation because I didn't come out till I was sort of old enough to be on my own. But I did have an affirming family in a lot of ways that appreciated my originality, and they didn't even have a problem with any sort of gender nonconformity things I might do. And I was super into the arts, and I wanted to be a dancer, and they totally affirmed that, both of my parents, and they would come to my shows, and this was just ordinary for my family. And so that really helped me when I decided to come out, that I didn't expect my parents to be all gung-ho about that particular issue, but I didn't have to worry. I had my self-esteem intact. But if a young kid comes out as a teenager, then unfortunately that becomes the issue, right? And
yeah.
And if they don't have the formation, if they're not having the understood acceptance like you had and like what I had, it's hard to get over. And I see so many people just struggling with this to this day, you know, even much later, years later, and trying to recover basically from that. So
I mean, I think you said it very well on your blog post in the No More Strangers blog, where you said, we don't suffer from homosexuality, we suffer from homophobia. And I think that's also what the research from Caitlin Ryan and Bob Reese is saying as well, that the drugs, the promiscuous sex, the trouble with the law, the suicide, they don't come from being gay. They come from being not accepted. Being gay is an experience that is highly correlated with being not accepted in some cultures.
Let's talk about your 12 friends. One more theme that was anecdotal, but what happened with the evolution of these guys and yourself in the context of the idea of your relationship with the church and of the idea of pursuing same-sex relationships versus the other options that you saw when you initially started approaching the issue?
Yeah, so none of these 12 gay friends, including myself, I think if you were to go back and ask who we were a few years ago, where we thought we would be right now, none of us are on the trajectory we thought. All of us thought we would be somewhere within the mainstream of Mormonism. So while none of us is on the path that we thought we were headed down, all of us are in some ways or another gay men, which is what we thought we would not be back a few years ago.
You probably started off not even using that term, but now all of you are sort of have endorsed this idea that you are actually gay and you embrace the label.
Yeah, I mean, we had this really weird, in some ways what we had a few years ago was super weird, because it would be like, you know, if you got a major calling as an Elders Quorum president, or if you got a girlfriend, that was what made everyone more interested in you. It was almost like you were more interested, even romantically, without saying it to yourself, in people who had what you thought you wanted.
So like the guy who goes on Craigslist and advertises for a return missionary.
Exactly. Yeah. That guy. I didn't know that guy existed, but
He exists. He was getting some teasing, you might say.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say that, like, if I was listening, if, you know, freshman in college, sophomore in college, Carrie was listening to this podcast, I know that he would be threatened by what I've said has been the outcome of my life. And I just want to let him know that he should not be. That my life has turned out to be far more interesting than I ever thought it would be, and fulfilling in many ways. And I wish that, I think that I always knew that my life plan was kind of betting against the odds, that it wasn't incredibly likely that I would be able to fully make things work within the mainstream of Mormonism, but that while that's definitely possible and a happy path for some people, that it's not the most common path. And I think that I thought I was an exception, and I was making choices that could have potentially affected the path of my whole life based off of the faulty assumption that I was going to be exceptionally unique. And I'm glad that things played out the way that they did.
You mean unique in that for a gay person to stay in the church and be happy, this is what's really unique. There's hardly anyone in that category.
Yes, I did mean that. I don't mean any disrespect for people that are in that path and are happy, and I don't question their own, I mean, how they evaluate their life and their happiness. But I do think, and this is a hypothesis, I've never seen data except for in the life of my 12 gay friends, that the common trajectory is not to end up as a Mormon in the mainstream of Mormonism.
Well, there is data, actually, and John DeLynn also is doing a lot of research in this realm, but it is showing that there's a good 70% of people who are gay end up leaving the church. So it's much higher than mainstream statistics of how many people leave the church. So yeah, what you're saying, though, is that your 12 friends decided that they were going to pursue same-sex relationships or gay relationships, and that they were going to change their relationship with the church either by leaving or at least, you know, having enough distance that they were going to pursue the relationships. That's what you're saying, is that all of you kind of independently came to that place.
Yeah, and where I'm issuing a small warning is that for people who are counting on their lives being exceptional and being unique in the sense of that they will be this person who makes it in the mainstream of Mormonism, you can make major life decisions based off that assumption that will make things difficult. Luckily, I guess, like, you know, you have different concerns in your mind. When I was moving to a new city, it's the difference between, you know, looking for a city that has a supportive gay scene and looking for a city that has an amazing singles ward.
Right.
And luckily, most of those cities are the same. You know,
That's true. The best singles ward are in Boston and San Francisco and DC probably, right?
You know, there are other similar types of decisions to make that can be affected by where you think the trajectory of your life is headed.
No, I hear that. I mean, when I was applying for residency, I was thinking, oh, it'd be really cool to go somewhere like North Dakota and just, you know, be in this rural setting. But maybe not, you know, not as a single young gay man, you know.
Yeah, I don't know if I've shared this, but I think I will. When I was first deciding to be a doctor, it was this completely delusional, self-important, but also self-sacrificing thing where I thought, well, I guess I'm going to be celibate my entire life. I had read a biography by the doctor who did Doctors Without Borders, and I had decided I will just become a doctor and I will go and be a doctor in a dangerous, war-torn region of the world and not care about money and just try to help people because that is what will make me happy. And if I die early because of this, then who cares? It was kind of the thought. It was like, you know, the next milestone for me within the LDS life pathway was only really available to me after death. And that milestone was getting married to a woman.
And you didn't really have a life to have for yourself. So the only life you could possibly have was giving it to others. And there's virtue in giving your life to others, but I think it's hard to argue that you should not also have a life of your own. So
yeah,
I'm glad you moved to a different place.
For sure. But I do think it's, I'm maybe just realizing it now, that it's just kind of like these formative choices that have now affected my whole life. I'm stuck in the second year of med school, tearing my hair out. And I was affected by this view of where my life could go. And I, luckily for me, I think medicine's going to be a fantastic career, and I'm glad I'm in this field. But, you know, it might not have worked out that way.
Yeah. Well, you've got a point. Let me argue slightly on the side that a lot of us end up in the right place for the wrong reason, you know. So that's not just gays. A lot of us go down paths that we really are totally delusional about. So, but your point is good, is that the people do make assumptions, young gay people especially, about what they can really do, what's realistic for them. And they do set themselves up for a lot of suffering and a lot of failure because they aren't realistic about what it takes to make a mixed orientation marriage work, or what they're giving up by choosing a life of celibacy, or what is going to scratch at them, you know, in other ways by participating or not. I mean, the life outside of the church isn't all a bed of roses either, and life in the gay community isn't a bed of roses. And we have to be realistic that, you know, it's not perfect anywhere, but it does help if you have some self-awareness about where you can succeed and how you can succeed. And if you can at least hold off on the major decisions till you really know where you are. And often we're not given the choice to do that. And I'm glad your trajectory turned out so positive. And I really hope that more people can have that access to that, a trajectory that works, and that, you know, we pass through our dramas and traumas, but we come out of it stronger and healthier. Once again, it comes back to the family a lot of times who ends up doing that.
Definitely. Definitely.
Yeah. But let's talk a little bit more about your emergence as a gay man. You know, you started dating, but here you are at BYU. I mean, what was your last year like in this context? I mean, here you are kind of an identified person, sort of a, now you're being profiled, right? I mean, they're watching you. They probably know you're gay, right? You've certainly been public. Was your public stature a protection, or was it a liability? Do you have a sense of that? Did you find yourself in any kind of risky situations? Was it possible to date at all without just kind of living in fear? What was it? What was that ambience like?
So I was protected, I think, by being visible. At least I don't know. I mean, all I know is that I never was contacted by BYU about my letter to the editor or anything else. And I'm very grateful for that. And I'm glad that a lot of my fears seem to be unfounded. Although maybe if I hadn't been so cautious, maybe it would have been different. One thing that I did notice that came from my letter is that I started to get a lot of Facebook messages from other gay BYU students who, most of them not identifying themselves as gay, but probably, I think in retrospect, a lot of them probably were just reaching out to me, and not always clear what they were looking for, but I think most of them were looking for someone to talk to. And this was right when the Understanding Same Gender Attraction Club was starting, and I was going to it, and there was about 5 members. And right now that club is huge. Over 100 people show up, and they do wonderful things for LGBT students on that campus, at least giving, if nothing else, giving a social place of refuge where they don't have to go up to Logan and meet their 12 gay friends. They can do that on or near campus.
And at least the isolation is removed somewhat for those people who can take advantage of it.
Exactly. And then also, I was dating at this time. After my first gay kiss and breaking up with my girlfriend, there were opportunities to date, and I took advantage of them. And it was so exciting and also terrifying. I think when I talk to friends here at medical school who aren't from a Mormon background about it, the way that they have told me to explain it to people is to say, you know, the best drinking happens before you're 21, when you can get caught. And it, there's like this element of sneaking around and getting away with something. And I think that in my dating experience, I think that's a good analogy. Like there was kind of this excitement about dating while at BYU.
So there was something compelling about the forbiddenness of it, because even though you were now allowing it, it was still kind of forbidden. And that actually enhanced the excitement. It made it compelling.
Yeah, it made it compelling. It also made it dreadfully emotional. And if you look at least when I was there, the people who were dating at BYU, it was just this high drama scene. You know, everybody had dated each other, and relationships tended to end in fire as opposed to ice. And, there would just be big blow-ups. And, you know, my first two dating experiences was two separate kind of longish lasting relationships. So I was a little bit isolated from what was going on around me, but it was still a part of my life. One thing that was difficult was finding actually places to be with your boyfriend. And probably the most telling story I can tell you about that is that two separate times I was caught, I think is the right word, by Provo City police kissing my boyfriend in a car parking lot of like a park late at night, because there was nowhere else for us to go. We couldn't, neither of us would risk kissing each other on the couch back at our apartment in Provo, and we didn't have family houses around, and there wasn't really a public space to go to in Provo. You know, this was at a time when alcohol wasn't a part of my life, and I didn't really want to go to clubs up in Salt Lake. And so really the only place was in the car somewhere parked along the streets of Provo. And
BYU students never park in cars and kiss. Never, right?
So these would be places where you would pull up and take your spot right next to a bunch of other people who I think also were engaged similarly. But it was always very scary when Provo City police found us. And yeah, I think as it would be for anyone. But my experience the second time that this happened, I really wonder if it was typical for everyone else in that parking lot who might have been caught by the same policeman. My boyfriend at the time and I are kissing each other in the car, and all of a sudden we hear a knock on the window and we see the flashlight. And of course, this is a terrifying experience. Everybody back to your seats, get your seatbelt on type situation.
Right.
And the policeman is just kind of talking to me casually at first and telling me, you know, like, what are you doing? This is a closed park. And he looks over and sees my boyfriend. And I think he all of a sudden becomes very tense. And I remember at that point, he tells us, do not move. And so I'm kind of like sitting there like, all right. And he says, show me your hands. And he made us put our hands in the air. And I remember the music was playing on my iPod. And so I was going to turn it off. And as I reached for it, he said, what are you doing? Keep your hands in the air. And so I have them in the air. And the worst possible thing happens. While we are sitting there, unable to move our hands, my iPod is on shuffle, and Come Follow Me, hymn number 116, sung by the Mormon Tabernacle Choir, starts playing over the radio.
Just the moment.
And we have to just sit there listening to it with our hands in the air, because we've been told we cannot move our hands. We cannot turn.
Well, at least it wasn't Lady Gaga, huh?
Well, no. So the reason we were really terrified by this is not just all of the years of emotional trauma that a song like that in that situation can bring up, but because, you know, we were terrified that this police officer was going to somehow, this was going to get back to BYU and we would be kicked out of school. And I, you know, having a Mormon song go across the iPod wasn't a great way to kind of camouflage. I remember what he told us was that we needed to leave and never come back to that park, that he had taken down our license and was giving us a warning. And he said, if I ever see you in this park again, I'm going to arrest you. And he told me that we could be sex offenders for the rest of our lives. And all of those things were, I just am very skeptical that the same kind of conversation is had when one of the offending couples is a man and the other is a woman. And that was that was a tough experience for both of us, and I think more so for my boyfriend at the time. And
what's even tougher is that the police was probably being compassionate. I mean, he could have done worse, and he'd probably seen colleagues do worse, and he probably had enough dissonance about that that he, even though he seemed harsh, he actually let you go, which was the right thing to do, you know. So, I mean, it's hard to feel grateful to him when he was also traumatizing you that way. But on the other hand, you know, I guess I recognize at least he didn't arrest you, right?
Yes, of course. I totally recognize that as well. I think it would have been bizarre if we'd been arrested in 2012 for that. But I think a few years ago, decades ago, I wouldn't be surprised if that experience had been not just emotionally traumatizing, but could have been much, much worse.
No, I mean, the history of the cooperation between Provo Police and BYU, and there's really terrible stories. I mean, in the 60s and 70s, about just that thing, or they'd have police plants, they'd have models pretend they were gay men, and if you put your hand on your leg, you'd get arrested, and people were actually sent to jail. I mean, it wasn't just kicked out of BYU, it was literally sent to jail. And so when he said you will have sex offender status for the rest of your life, he was talking about something in the past, but not so long in the past that, you know, it was outside of my lifetime that these things were actually happening. And we don't know how much they still do, but there are still ways that people are having their lives damaged and their futures damaged by the interaction with BYU standards. And that's just how it comes about, right?
Yeah, definitely. And I'm glad that I was spared from that.
Yeah, well, me too. It would have delayed you by possibly a year. But anyway, you sort of managed to have some fun times just the same. You dated. You started to experience what most people get to experience as adolescence, which is, you know, your first romantic moments, kissing in a car, sneaking away, all these great things that we need to do as part of growing up, right? You finally were getting to do.
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about now your career trajectory? You know, you did something amazing. You got into Harvard Med School, and that is no small feat. That is the most competitive medical school in the country, the hardest to get into, also the most prestigious. And so besides saying congratulations, just kind of tell me about that process and how this all plays in. You're being a medical student, being gay, being a medical school applicant. I know you've got a scholarship. Tell me about that stuff some more.
So I think one of the major take-home points I want to give about applying to med school for other students who might be in this situation where they're coming out of the closet, leaving BYU and applying to grad school, is that I had a really long resume and application, but the only topic that came up in every single interview I had was my LDS mission. And it was something I had to be really ready to address. And it was, I think interviewers just, you need to be able to have peace enough with your past to be able to talk about that experience in a way that lets your interviewer know that you are someone who is passionate about things that you do, and yet you're also self-aware enough to recognize that to make peace with the complexities of your life. And I think that there are certain interviews where I did that really well, and I had great answers about my mission, and there were other interviews when I did not. And the schools that I was accepted to just happened to correlate with the ones where I was able to give a good answer when they asked me about my Mormon mission. So it's something that doesn't go away. It's 2 years of your life that you're accounting for, and even if you have left the Mormon church at the time you're applying, it's something that you're going to have to be ready to talk about. And it's something that I think a lot of places, you know, Harvard's not known for being like the religious bastion for Mormonism, especially. And my Mormon mission was something that I was able to set me apart from other applicants and help me get into medical school because I knew how to talk about it. I think that it's just something you need to be aware of when you're going to apply.
Right. Well, they're interested that you are a person who's ambitious, who has get up and go, who's going to pursue actions. And so even if they might not be that sympathetic to the ideology of why you went on a mission, it's certainly easy to frame that, or could be easy to frame that as just showing that you had a passion for service. And even if you've moved to a different relationship with your religion, which is perfectly okay to point out, or not, you can sort of frame that as all the skills you got out of that, all this learning experience you had by interacting with the culture in another way, and how it sort of helped you evolve into the person you are, which is a person who's more open to life experiences, world experiences, or different cultures, or seeing needs in a different way that you recognize by working directly with people in that context. So I think I totally agree with you that it can be a big plus on any application, even if you are no longer a Mormon, or if you are, in either case. And it is important, right, to try to understand how it might appeal to the party you are interviewing with, right, and to frame it that way. And Harvard is looking for diversity, and so they don't want just a bunch of atheists. You know, they want people from all religions. So it's not, they're not going to give you points against you for being a Mormon, right?
They at least want one Mormon in every class, so.
Right. How about one gay Mormon?
It's wonderful to be a gay Mormon if you're applying for grad school these days.
Oh, good. Well, we need our advantages once in a while, huh?
Yes, yes. Something to say about that is, you mentioned the scholarship I had. I was lucky enough to be chosen by the Point Foundation to be one of their point scholars for this preceding year. And this is something that I'm glad you brought up. I would really like to highlight it. The Point Foundation is a scholarship organization that gives social, emotional, and financial support to promising LGBT students who are, and also their allies, who are applying for school. And what they've done for me is they've given, not only have they given me tuition to help pay this, the astronomical cost of attending medical school these days, but they have assigned me a mentor who I meet with regularly and who helps support me in, you know, my life and in my career. And you, it's a really great opportunity to network with other students your age who are really involved in the LGBT community. And it's something that if you are a LGBT identified person or an ally who doesn't think that school is a great option for you right now, especially if you've been rejected from your home or lost financial support in the process of coming out, you are the type of person that the Point Foundation is looking to support. You should definitely go to their website and look to apply. I actually think their deadline might have just passed for this year, but it's something that they do every year, and it's been a wonderful, wonderful opportunity and support system for me.
Yeah, well, it was also a big honor. I mean, you, even though it is really focusing on gay and lesbians who've had a hard time, they're also focusing on gay and lesbians who have amazing potential. And I think that's what you're seeing in the people who win that scholarship, is people like yourself who they say, man, this is someone who is going to make a difference in the gay community and is going to make a difference in the world. And, you know, this got you featured in Advocate magazine, which is the most important gay news magazine, because of your relationship with the Point Foundation. And it was kind of an outcome of this letter that you didn't think was such a huge deal at the time, but it was partly how you handled it, and it was partly what this meant in that, in the context at that time and place in Mormonism and how it's fitting into with the gay movement at the time. So I think it's fantastic that you're involved with them. And it's also interesting that the Point Foundation specifically has a number of high-profile gay former Mormons or current Mormons on their board.
So I thought when I was applying, I thought being gay and Mormon would just make them feel sorry for me. Well, what it did is it was a connection. Like you said, I was shocked when I went to their interview conference that I met at least four or five gay Mormon men who, at least who were raised Mormon and are now advocates and activists in the LGBT community working with the Point Foundation.
Yeah. Well, and I'm excited to about that fact. And what's come to my attention in getting more exposed to the issue of Mormons gays is there are some amazing activists who come out of that. And they're not just activists in Utah. I mean, we're talking activists at the Southern Poverty Law Center, We're talking about Point Foundation. We're talking about Trevor Project. For example, George or Jorge Valencia, who was a BYU student, is a prominent member of the board of Point Foundation. And he was also, before that position, he was a very important person at Trevor Project. And so I'm excited. I'm hoping I can interview some of these people. Jim DeBacchus is involved with Point Foundation. He's involved with a lot of stuff. He's an amazing person. But there's quite a few people that really have some impressive resumes in the community, and not just as gay activists, but as activists in general. So
Jim DeBacchus is my mentor through the Point Foundation, and he's just a phenomenal example of what someone can do, how they can not be limited by, you know, the hardship that they might have faced growing up, and instead used it to just become this phenomenal person capable of tremendous change. And I think Jim especially is able to use his connections through his Mormonism to help him make the changes that are really affecting the LGBT community. As Jim was just elected a state senator in Utah very recently in the last few months. And let's see what he will be doing in that position.
Well, he's amazing because he's so funny. I mean, I just love watching or hearing him speak. But he's just effective at making the changes that need to be made or making the connections behind the scenes. And so, you know, there's a lot to say great about him. I'm really excited to see what he's going to do in his new role. And so it's great to hear that you're connected to some of these people. These are going to be great mentors and great role models. And I see, Carrie, I don't want to sing your praise too much, but I really totally see you doing great things like that. And so I think Point Foundation picked the right guy because I think you have activism at your core, and I know there's a great place within medicine for a person like you. And I know you've already started that. You've started down that path, and I know through Point Foundation you have done some activism. So tell us about it.
I appreciate your vote of confidence. Through the Point Foundation, every year you're required to do a community service project. And what I was decided to focus on was I decided to do a sexual health symposium really targeted towards the LGBT community in Provo, Utah. And as you can imagine, there wasn't much to go on or much precedent could be done. But it was probably one of the most challenging and fulfilling things that I've ever been able to do with my life.
Yeah, well, that's amazing. That was a much neglected thing. So I'm really impressed that you stumbled onto that idea of picking a totally unserved community, which would be the lesbian gay community of Utah Valley, and promoting information that they really need about sexual health. So tell me just a little bit about the conference. Who was there? What was it?
Let me get my spiel on. So the conference involved activists from throughout Utah and also throughout the country. I flew in a physician from Fenway Health, which is here in Boston with me. It is
which is the gay and lesbian medical providing center in Boston, one of the icons of gay and lesbian health throughout the country, right?
Definitely. It's the largest LGBT community health center in the country, and they do a lot of amazing research there. And a physician is someone that I'd met while shadowing there, and I was able to drag him along with me. Luckily, he'd actually had experience in Utah because of some methamphetamine conferences that had been held there. Meth is a problem that both the Mormon and gay communities share. And brought some important gay health activists to Utah. So he'd already been, he knew that it was a beautiful place, and he agreed to come with me, which was just a phenomenal thing. I also got George Valencia or Jorge to come up from LA, and he gave a really touching story about his own coming out process at BYU. And really what he was there for was to tell us about the consequences that he's seen in his own life, or mostly in the lives of his friends, from what happens when someone doesn't have a great knowledge about sexual health and becomes sexually active and the kind of what can happen. And he, I mean, he grew up in the generation that really experienced the brunt of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. And just having him there and sharing that story was really impactful for a lot of people. Also, we had Carolyn Pearson come and we gave her an award. She makes a hilarious statement in the symposium where she says that when she first received the award and she was telling people back in the Bay Area about this symposium she's going, that it was really hard to explain to them that she wasn't receiving an award for her own exceptional sexual health, but rather for how she was able to bring sexual health, especially in the LGBT community, to the awareness of the typical average everyday Mormon person almost a decade or so before its time. And that was her memoir, Goodbye, I Love You, about her experience with her husband.
Right. Well, she certainly deserves that and lots of awards because, you know, sexual health really follows on the cusp of getting rid of the homophobia. And you talked about that, how the friends of yours who didn't have the healthy self-concept because of the way their families treated them are the same ones who got involved in risky sexual behavior. And Carolyn Pearson, by being such a strong advocate for gays and lesbians in general, has done a lot for their sexual health, which has led to them not getting HIV as much and not using drugs as much and not attempting suicide as much, all those things. So she sort of deserves that award. And I had the luck of interacting with her on the first podcast we did with this, the Gay Mormon Stories, where she talked about the hero's journey. So anyone who hasn't listed that already, please do. And please support her projects. She's got two of them going on right now, that publication, and that's really her bread and butter. So she deserves our support, but also it's worth it because you can buy a really great publication that makes a great gift. And also there's the Faces Facing East movie project, which is a motion picture that we're trying to get produced, that they're trying to get produced, which is based on a play she wrote. So please try to look for ways of supporting those projects, all you people out there. So anyway,
I mean, it's easy to see why she would be famous because of the content she tackles, but it's not just her content. If you've ever read her poems or her plays, she is just a phenomenal, talented writer and artist. And I'm always enriched whenever I see anything she's done or listen to her speak.
Yeah, well, she's inspired a lot of people in our community. So anyway, well, so you got her and she was a speaker there. And so, you know, I have to tell you, I listened to the podcast that you guys published and I thought it was a brilliant success. I hope that they keep up this tradition. It got people talking in the different agencies there. It gave exposure of those issues to a lot of people. But the point is even people who didn't attend, which is the majority of people who need it, obviously, it's still available online. You can get there through Gay Mormon Stories. I actually have a link. If you just go down my list of things on Gay Mormon Stories page, I actually sent a link to that podcast and the page there. So I suggest y'all listen to that story if you haven't and know what that it was Carrie who really spearheaded that idea.
Yeah. So what was so great about it is, I mean, it was an opportunity where I could call in my friends and connections that I still had in Provo. And instead of just getting together to see a movie, we got together to plan a conference. And
yeah, that's what we do for fun around here. Huh?
And it was actually way more fun. You know, my friend Katie Jolly was my co-organizer. She's a business. She's getting her business degree, and she was just a phenomenal businesswoman and presenter throughout the process. My friend Derek Clements did all of our audiovisual. My friend Craig Mangum did our design. And it was just everyone who contributed did a fantastic job.
Umberta Marquez, she helped with the sound, this podcast that I actually posted.
Phenomenal, yes. She helped record our event and has been editing for us so that we can get our content online.
And you can hear her podcast on my Gay Mormon Stories. She was the first person I interviewed. She's got a great story, by the way.
Barrett is a fantastic human being. Everyone should listen to that. In fact, you should stop listening to mine right now and go listen to
Hopefully you've already listened to it, but Carrie, yours is also brilliant. So I think everyone's going to want to hear both.
And then just to close about who was at the symposium, one thing that was very encouraging is that all of the community organizations we invited, the Utah AIDS Foundation, the Pride Center, the Planned Parenthood, Centro Hispano, which has a target demographic of people who are Spanish language speaking, and many others came and they brought booths, they brought materials, they helped connect people who attended to testing services and prevention materials, and all of that was, and the feedback was that this was just this phenomenal event where they had never really had an outreach event like this, where they could reach their target demographic. And then finally, through Carolyn Pearson's connection, we were visited by Provo's mayor. Mayor Curtis came and gave us his blessing. And, you know, Mayor Curtis is a wonderful, upstanding LDS family man politician. And I can say he is not an enemy. He is a friend, I think, to the LGBT community. And I think he really showed that by showing up to the symposium.
Okay, well, that's nice to hear. So here you are, you know, you're doing the activism, but meanwhile, you're in the midst of the hell of being a medical student. I know all about that. But, you know, it sounds like you've arrived at a place where you're on the cusp of doing great things and finishing a really difficult process, which is medical school and residency. You still got that ahead of you. But there you are at Harvard, and out. Gay man, you're involved with some of the gay community there in Boston or at Harvard?
Yeah, I'm the co-president of our student LGBT group. You know, BYU is not the only place that needs reform. I've been surprised by how much work there is to do here at Harvard Medical School, and we've been involved in education reform and in general reforms around campus to make it a more accepting place. I mean, obviously, we're talking about completely different scales when you're comparing BYU being an accepting place versus Harvard, but there's still always work to be done. And I really think getting, you know, kind of like the baptism by fire of trying to do activism in an environment like BYU has been helpful moving forward and trying to do activism in other venues.
And what about the dating scene for a gay young Mormon in Boston going to Harvard? Any time for that?
There's definitely time if you make it. And I will say, all I'm going to say is that it always makes for wonderful conversation on a first date. You never have that awkward silence, because as soon as you tell the person you're on a date with that you were raised Mormon, the rest of the date is conversation is covered.
Yep, there you go. And the inevitable joke, oh, so are you a polygamist?
Yeah, I've been asked that plenty of times. I tell them, I tried to have one wife, and that was very difficult for me. And so I'm glad that I never had to go for more than that.
Yeah, well, so what about your current connection to Mormonism? I mean, would you sort of update us on where you're at with that and how you see yourself as a Mormon or as a, however you call yourself at this point? Can you summarize that for me?
Yeah, so when I'm asked, I say I was raised Mormon. And I think what I really am relying with that answer is I think about Joanna Brooks often talks about this, and I think she got it from her husband's Jewish experience somewhere. I think that's how I remember it. But she talks about in a relationship to a religion, you have kind of three aspects. You have your behavior, your beliefs, and your belonging, your sense of belonging to the organization. And I would say that I am not currently behaving or believing like a Mormon, but I still feel a belonging there. And it's something that I don't necessarily want to run away from all the time. Now, there are certainly times when that gets challenged, when things that the Mormon Church does makes me want to run away and to deny that I ever was connected. But there are more times when I look back at my upbringing and the good things that I have in my life, and I recognize how much of them do come as part of the influence of Mormonism on my life. And when I see that, that is when I really do want to belong, and I want to continue, at least as focusing on that community as a community to serve and be a part of as I move forward.
Well, and I think you mentioned that about your upbringing. I mean, this Mormonism that you maybe when you say your behavior and participation may not be fully Mormon at this time. I mean, a lot of your behaviors are fully Mormon. I mean, you internalized service. You internalized a lot of things about how you believe in family and how you believe in relationships and morality, and those aren't gone, you know, even if you're not going to church and even if you aren't following their exact rules about gay relationships. I suspect you're following the vast majority of Mormon rules, even if there's a couple you no longer feel that apply to you or feel that you believe in.
Yeah, I mean, I don't check the rule book anymore.
No more worthiness interviews anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, so I don't check the rule book, but many of the rules have become second nature, and that is all right. I don't feel like I need to run away from that.
You're not going to pick up smoking cigarettes then?
Yeah, not at all. And, you know, growing up Mormon, I have in my room, I'm in my room now so I can go check it out. But hanging in my room is a card that my mom sent me this year. It was such a peace-giving gift that she gave me when it came in the mail that I think really explains for me what Mormonism has done for me in my life. And the card has like a mother-looking fairy chasing a little baby-looking fairy through the air, which is appropriate. And on the inside it says, "Gone so soon. Oh, had I a golden thread and a needle so fine." This is in my mom's writing. "I would weave a magic spell." And then she says, "I was under an illusion I could protect you from the hurts of this world. Bummer. Love you, Mom." And, you know, what that card does for me is it tells me what Mormonism was for me and to my mom when I was growing up. And it was really just this blanket that she could wrap around me when she saw how cold and discouraging and dark the world could be. She wanted to give me something to protect me from that. And that's what Mormonism was. And it was really effective, especially when I was a child, where any challenge that I had, I felt equal to. I felt like I would overcome everything. And I knew God loved me. And I knew that he was more powerful than anything I was facing. And that really brought me through and made me resilient. And then there was just one point where the blanket wasn't big enough for where I needed to go, or it was smothering me. And I've had to move on a little bit and change my relationship with the church, but it doesn't change what it did for me in my most formative years. Right. And I will always be grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice way of sort of thinking of that. And that was nice of your mother to sort of get that this was relevant to you. So speaking, you know, since you don't have this narrative that you were sort of fed all your life, but you still have similar goals for your future. So what I want to know really is, what is your wishes for the future? I mean, tell me your biggest wishes. I know that wishes don't have to necessarily all come true, but I think it's relevant to know where you would like to see yourself, and as far as family, as far as future, as far as relationships, as far as everything. Where do you see yourself?
Well, I better be happy. I can tell you that. The whole point of changing the life trajectory was recognizing that the one I was on wasn't necessarily, I didn't think was going to lead me to happiness. But going forward, I have a lot of the same goals. I want to find somebody I love and who loves me back. I want to have a family with that person. I would love to have a child that is half me and half the person I love. But if not, that's not the case, I'll have a child that I can adopt into my family who I will love fully just the same. I want to be involved in what I see as positive changes that are happening in the world right now, especially in regards to LGBT issues. I think that I live in, you know, it's like what the scientific revolution was for science. This time in LGBT history is a time when more progress is being made faster than in decades and millennium before. And I'm very lucky to kind of be growing up in the crux of it and to be a part of it. It gives my life a similar kind of purpose that I used to take from being Mormon. You know, when I was a Mormon missionary and I believed the church wholeheartedly, there was nothing. I didn't feel like there was anything I could be doing with my life that could possibly be more important than what I was doing right then.
Yeah.
And there have been few times since then when I felt that way about activism I've been able to do in the LGBT community. And that is a wonderful blessing. And I don't think I would have that same purpose if all of these battles had already been won.
Okay. Well, I think you're going to succeed in those wishes. They may not come exactly in that order, but I suspect there's going to be some lucky guy who's going to find you and that you're going to make this happen. And having a family is no longer this weird idea for gay people. Gay people are having children. Lesbians have had children for a long time, but now gay men are having children in different ways. And we're seeing that. And there's foster care, there's adoption, there's surrogacy, and the future is a wide open possibility for you, and you're going to make it happen. So I'm excited to see that evolve. I hope to hear from you more, and maybe we'll have to do some sort of updated podcast to talk about how these things develop in your life after you've had a chance to experience them. So, but for now, I'll let you finish medical school and study for boards, okay? I'll leave you alone for a couple months anyway.
Yeah, I'm just going to say my life's become incredibly boring since going to medical school, so I don't know how long it's going to take for there to be something to update everyone on.
Well, just think, you've been working your butt off for all these years just to do something incredibly boring, which is study for boards, which is one of the most boring things on earth. But it gets better. Medical school, the medical career gets better. PG, you're saying your medical school is by far the worst. But let's go on, and let me give you a chance to sort of say some closing statements. You know, we kind of like to let people kind of close with what their testimony might be, but I'd like you to sort of give me your personal feelings and a personal summary as a way of closing this podcast.
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to address the idea that I'm still being told it gets better, and now I'm out of the closet, but now it's in context to medicine, so that's not encouraging.
Well, let me tell you how it would really get better. If you just realize you have to become a psychiatrist as the best medical specialist, I promise. But I don't know if I'm convincing you, am I?
You know, it's on my list. I have a short list of five, okay. And I'm not going to go into it, but it's on the list.
Okay. Well, do what you think is best. You need to do amazing things in this world. So maybe it will be as something that I can't predict for you. So anyway, but you'll have me cheering regardless of which one you choose.
Well, okay, so since you give me a little moment, I think what I think is most important is I often think about freshmen in college, Carrie, at BYU, and because that was the time when I think I was most at risk, freshman and sophomore year of college, of making choices that could have led me down a much different path. And what I would like to have heard as a freshman in college at BYU that could have helped me kind of get rid of the stress and pressure and terror that I was feeling. And recently I came across a poem from Mary Oliver, who's this prolific poet up here in New England, that just knocked me in my tracks. And I'm going to just share the first few lines from it. It's called Wild Geese. And it says, "You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves." I wish that I had heard that before, because I spent so much of my effort in my teen years and my young adult years just trying to be good and just trying to repent of something that I did not need to repent of. And I think that that burden needs to be lifted off of LGBT youth who grow up in Mormonism before we can really say our work is done with that community.
Right.
And that's it. That's what I want to share.
Well, thank you, and amen to that.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Carrie. Thank you so much for your time, and I'm really excited to be able to present your story to the listeners out there, because I think it's going to inspire a lot of young people. I think it's going to inspire a lot of families to see how someone can really live a life where being gay is not a barrier, but instead it's a strength. I'm expecting to hear your name a lot through the coming years, so don't let that be a pressure on you, okay? But, you know, we're rooting for you here.
I'm rooting for you as well. I'm very excited to see where this podcast goes.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson.
Shall thou